I am the voice of Pacifica Radio.
أنا صوت راديو باسيفيكا على KPFT 90.1 FM في هيوستن.
ونسكيزا 90.1 FM KPFT هيوستن.
يا واد هي باسيفيكا راديو KPFT 90.1 FM.
اوه هاي باسيفيكا توي كيسينج سين.
چلئے آج ہم سب مل کر کے اس دھرتی پہ شانتی کے لیے.
Chúng tôi muốn nói lên sự thật cho giới lãnh đạo được biết. Chúng tôi là Pacifica Radio KPFT 90.1 FM.
一同向和平進發，我哋係侯斯頓嘅 Pacifica KPFT 90.1 FM 90.1.
Mimi ni Pacifica, uhuru wa mazungumzo kwa watu walio huru.
हम ताकत के सामने भी सच्चाई से बोलते हैं. हम हैं Pacifica Radio KPFT 90.1 FM.
Let's all get together and pray for the peace on earth.
من غير العدالة مش ممكن نوجد السلام.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Welcome to a regular show of Technology Bites here on this station to which you are now listening.
Thanks for that, Flicted.
That was a terrible Jay Lee.
That is, you can do better than that.
You'd think
it.
After all this.
I've heard a better.
After all these years. Well, not for me, probably. I wouldn't think. But yes, hello and welcome to Technology Bites. We are Jay Lee free tonight.
Ah, thank God.
Yeah, jeez, boy. I've been hanging around for 20 years waiting for that. No, just kidding. and we're also Barrett free, but so before now, of course, everybody just turned off their radios, and they would, if they did that, they missed out on the fact that we've lined up a couple of people to replace them, to take their place for
permanently.
Tonight we have the triumphant return of zombie Dwight Silverman. And after his near-death experience. And no, we have Dwight Silverman back, and that's awesome. And we have a special guest, the Psy Guy, and he apparently is still the Psy Guy.
He's still the Psy Guy, although he's not the Kron Psy Guy.
There you go.
He's the Chronic Psy Guy.
No, gave up the Chronic. Old. Chronic
and that is Eric Berger, the guy who... who ruined more Houston weekends in the past month than...
Wow.
No, if you think about it, because they'd go read the blog, and it's like, what?
He single-handedly helped increase Houston's population by keeping people indoors on the weekend with nothing better to do.
Yeah, you're welcome.
There'll be burger babies in 9 months.
He ruined more Houston weekends than people who are afraid that if they went in the ladies' room, there would be transgender men in there.
So Eric now works with me over at Ars Technica, but Eric has an awesome weather blog for the Houston area that he continues to maintain. Eric, tell us about your super exciting weather blog.
It is a super exciting weather blog. It's called SpaceCityWeather.com. It is no hype weather information. So, watch TV to get the scoop on the weather dog and all the freaking out you need to do, and then you can come over to my site and find out what's going to happen.
Find the real world thing. So you're the new Wonderground now that they've gone commercial.
Houston Wonderground.
Hey, Wonderground is a great site, but I am solely devoted to Houston.
That's right.
So, there you go. Spot forecasts.
And what else matters, really, other than Houston?
Well, Houston's like a country's worth of weather, if you focus on it, frankly, by its sheer size.
We are. Although, as they pointed out in our fundraiser, now that we have the new transmitter at KPFT, we're reaching as far out as Sealy. So, residents of Sealy, we love you too, but we really still only care about Houston's weather.
Oh. Does I-10 go past Katy?
I don't know. I've never been up that way. It's like on my map, it says, like, here be dragons.
It gets all blurry after the Grand Parkway. All right, well, the basic show information, you can go to our website at geekradio.com. We have, just in case you want to, like, read ahead, we have links to all the different articles and source stuff that we might be talking about tonight. If you want to get on IRC...
Somebody
Which,
should probably get on IRC.
Yeah, I guess maybe I guess somebody
I'll,
should
I'll
hook up
that.
On there.
Let's see. I think I remember how IRC works. Hold on.
Yeah, I think it forgot my... In one of the various turmoils there, it...
Tell them the IRC address, Peter.
It's at cuckoo.com.
Cuckoo.
And if you don't know how to, like, navigate a...
Jay's on IRC.
Oh, hey, Jay's in IRC.
Oh, he's listening.
He doesn't have anything better to do in New Zealand.
Okay, so. Everybody, Ixnay on the Ajashing Bay. Something like that. No, anyways, no, you can go to cuckoo.com if you know how to use an IRC client. If you don't, we have the handy click the web link and it'll do it in your browser for you at geekradio.com. See, we keep circling you back there. You can find, you can also find us on Twitter and stuff like that, which... is again on the website, so that sets you up all around. Let's see. I guess that said, I'm Peter Hughes.
Oh man, I don't know which order to do this in. I'm Lee.
And then it's flicked.
I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Groovehouse.
I'm Dwight again.
And our special guest is
Eric Berger. There you go.
So, and Groovehouse, of course, for the ladies. But
perfect show!
maybe we don't do things in the right order or the usual order, but we do get to them eventually.
Yeah, eventually.
So, I guess...
Don't say so much. You got to be more extemporaneous, Peter. Come
yeah,
on, man.
No. If I'm going to sit in the hot seat, then you're going to hear more.
Jay is like totally making fun of you here in IRC. You need to load up your clients so you can see him making fun of you. Professional, he says.
Yeah, like that's ever been a standard for this show. Anyways, the nice part is, see, the thing is, the show sounds a whole lot better, but with all the lag to get around to New Zealand, then it kind of changes in transit, and so he should realize that in the streaming. Anyways, so I guess without further ado, maybe we should have Flicted press the button. We'll do the top news, and then we can just
go wait. On. I want to say it. This is going to be the Technology Bites info shot. So take it away, info shot.
It's the Technology Bites info shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Okay, well, we'll start with the top science fiction story of the week that you probably none of you have heard about because I only saw it on Boing Boing. Apparently, this week it was released a 1968 memo from Paramount producer Robert Justman to Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry that reported on the sad state of the show's hairpieces, which had gone missing in great numbers. William Shatner apparently took home, quote, all four of his rugs, something he made a habit of, and he was renowned for his ill use of his hairpieces to boot, but also Nichelle Nichols' wig, you know, Uhura's wig disappeared. From the memo, Majel Barrett's wig has disappeared. Nobody, including Majel, knows what has happened to it. Nichelle Nichols' wig has disappeared. She borrowed it when she finished working and claims that she returned it. But neither Freddie nor Pat Westmore know anything about it being returned. That takes us up to here on missing hair goods. Regards, Bob. This was the thing about this was from 1968. And the concern was that if they did it, should Star Trek go again next season, this no doubt means that we will have to construct new hairpieces again for Bill because he will have used both the old ones and the new ones to such an extent that they will not be photographable. This I guarantee, since it has happened to us before.
Pay abuse.
Great insight.
I feel like that was like a really long setup for a Trouble with Tribbles joke.
I just wonder what happened to his Buster Crab slimming girdle that Shatner used to wear all the time that you could obviously see underneath his gold top. But on from wig paranoia to more reasonable paranoia, apps in both Google Play and the Apple App Store frequently send users' highly personal information to third parties, often with little or no notice, according to recently published research that studied 110 apps. Found this from Dan Gooden at Ars Technica. So if you've been suspicious about your Android and iOS apps, you know, stealing your data and handing it off to places that you didn't expect, you're right on the money. The researchers analyzed 55 of the most popular apps from each market and found that a significant percentage of them regularly provided Google, Apple, and other third parties with user email addresses, names, and physical locations. On average, Android apps sent potentially sensitive data to 3.1 third-party domains, while the average iOS app sent it to 2.6 third-party domains. In some cases, health apps sent searches, including words such as herpes and interferon, to no fewer than 5 domains with no notification it was happening. So, you know, if I wanted them to shout out about herpes and interferon in front of the other people, I'd go to the drugstore. The results of the study point out that the current permission systems on iOS and Android are limited in how comprehensively they inform users about how much data sharing occurs. The authors of the study titled "Who Knows What About Me?" A survey behind the scenes personal data sharing to third parties by mobile apps wrote, quote, "Apps on Android and iOS today do not need to have permission request notifications for user inputs like P2 and behavioral data." So there's something to think about, especially on your phone. Obviously, that's reporting where you go and what you're doing. So you may want to. I'm not on the iOS. I know that you can go in and you can tell, you can control what apps have kind of constant access to sending back your stuff. Now you can't stop. You know, when you use it, it can send the stuff. but you can at least kind of reduce your exposure by limiting which apps you allow to communicate to home base more often. One thing that you could do, this is the advice from the people who, the researchers, suggested that you supply false data when possible to app requests. The researchers also said that apps can be redesigned to allow users to opt out of data collection and that app stores could more prominently inform users about third parties who may receive their data. I would think that you should have the right or ability to have a like public profile that you that would be... It seems like that would be a legitimate layer to the operating should be a legitimate layer of the operating system for Google or iOS, that it's like, okay, here's what I'm okay with publicly, you know, so you could have a username or some other thing where you know it's you, but other people can't necessarily. Although I don't at this point, I guess from the things I've seen with like large scale data mining, that if they have like an IP address or anything like that, they
you're
can
done.
Pretty
Come
much
back
figure out who
rest.
You are.
You're done.
They can figure out who you are from the rest of the information. But at the very least, knowing about it helps you to be informed and maybe make your opinion known if it comes up in comes up somewhere where you can make a difference. At some point, you know, some of these things are going to need, they're going to need, I think, some regulatory looking at, because leaving it Wild West and just sharing your information without even asking you, you know, because the sad part is they think that they need to do that, because if they popped up a thing that said, hey, you know, we've got some conditions and we might share your data, are you okay with that? 99% of people wouldn't even read that. They'd say, "Okay, yeah, share it.
Get off my screen."
It's like at least you asked. But
when you install an Android app, the Android app asks you detail, shows you in detail what it's going to do. That doesn't mean that that is all it's going to do, but it shows you more detail. And that's I kind of wish iOS would do that.
It seems like it would make sense to be more clear on it. Although, again, the average person's kind of like, yeah, I have no privacy anyway. Just take it. I'm done. You know, kind of thing. So,
speaking of which, I was looking ahead at the next topic. So tell us why else we should throw our computers and technology away and live in caves.
Oh, no. Well, you know, so maybe you're going to dump your tablet because you're tired of your privacy being violated and you're going to turn on your Vizio Smart TV. Well, apparently they track what you watch and sell your behavior data, but that's pretty much the thing about it is that it's not just Vizio. They pretty much all do it. It's just Vizio kind of got caught recently by ProPublica. You know, Vizio televisions have a reputation for good picture quality at low prices, but, you know, part of the trade-off is aggressive behavior tracking by default. The news report by ProPublica calls out Vizio for diving deeper into data collection than its rival TV makers. The company's, quote, smart interactivity, unquote, feature is enabled by default and analyzes everything that happens on the TV, from watching movies to playing games. Vizio then associates the data with an IP address, which can then identify other internet-connected devices in the home. So they even you don't even have to go back and like comb through the mine for this. They do it for the people they provide the data.
You know, the thing is that I always thought that any DVR device, Comcasts, UVerse, that they're all reporting back what you are watching, what you're doing, how long you watch it, whether you skip commercials. I mean, I suspect that that's from everybody. Hopefully, it's in aggregate and it's not specific.
It's supposed to be anonymized, except again the IP address gives a general location, and you know, I think
yeah,
you could
on,
put
man.
I think you could put a lot of information together about a person. It seemed like some of the studies I've seen, it didn't take very much before they could know who
right
who it was.
Question is, when you have all those IP addresses and you know you have thousands and thousands, and potentially with a company like Vizio, which sells millions of TVs, millions of them, are they going to bother to go and say, let's see what Peter Hughes is watching?
Right.
Today.
I don't know. You just
Well, they might. That's big data, and big data can now be purchased as a service. You can get analytics on all kinds of gigantic piles of things. And you know these companies, you trust them about as far as you can throw their corporate office buildings. I wouldn't really put anything past them, frankly. Not when this is all tied to, you know, helping to drag, you know, 1% additional revenue to help meet their quarterly guidance. I mean, you know, there's absolutely no limits on that for behavior that they would do for stuff like that. I don't know, maybe that's too cynical, but I just feel like I read all this stuff and I think, well, yeah, that makes sense. Yep, well, that figures.
The thing that puzzles me, though, is if they have all this data they've gathered on all of us, they're keeping track of it, they've got massive databases full of all of it, how come the ads that I get on these sites that are supposed to be so smart are so off base?
Maybe they know you better than you know yourself.
You kind of go, okay, you know, so you can't even say, well, at least for the total violation of my privacy and sharing all my data with big corporate America, well, at least they knew that I needed a new pair of shoes or whatever, you know. But no, instead they give me stuff for things that I really don't... I'm not in the market for.
I want to relate this bizarre experience because it's worth creeping everybody else out.
How bizarre was it?
So I was on This Week in Tech a few months ago, and one of the sponsors was Harry's, which is this shaving thing over the internet. Blades are a lot cheaper. Everything is a lot cheaper, and so you get it. And I decided that
Harry's,
yes. Uh-huh. And I decided that I was going to do this. I mean, I figure that, you know, one blade usually lasts me like 6 months because I don't have much to shave. And so I decided I was going to do this. So I went to the Harry's site and I looked it up and I started to buy. And I decided, no, I'm not going to do it. I didn't complete the transaction. Mm. For a week after that, every ad I saw on almost every website that I went to was for Harry's. It was like, you need to come back. Come back, Dwight. And finally, I did. And when I did, I saw maybe about a day or two of it, and then it stopped. Huh. It was very creepy.
That's like getting the crazy ex-girlfriend experience without ever actually dating this person.
That's right.
But, oh, geez. Yeah, I noticed there are companies that there are certain sites that I've noticed. Right. If I go to them, that then suddenly their ads follow me. Academy is one that is really big on that.
Right. Ugh, yeah. And Amazon. So if you go and you look at anything on Amazon, when you come back, you get all these ads for it. I bought, like, plain old Tidy Whiteys. And
and now we know.
And for 2 months after I purchased that on Amazon, I kept seeing pictures of men in Tidy Whiteys in the side of, like, I already bought it. Leave me alone. I don't want to see that. It was annoying.
Maybe it'll help you buy more Tidy Whiteys.
Your iOS app reported that you had the most boring porn collection of anybody on that tablet.
Yeah.
For those 3 weeks.
I kind of felt like I had a Tidy Whitey app.
You know, Dwight, you could have said socks.
So, and finally, this one's, I didn't know where to put it, but, and it's kind of, it's interesting to see where it will go, because I kind of wondered if by now Bluetooth would be kind of passé, except for, you know, headphones on your smartphone, but apparently there's a whole 2016 roadmap that's out, and they want to do all kinds of stuff, connected homes, and other applications in the Internet of Things universe. Most notably, Bluetooth is aiming to increase the range of Bluetooth 4.0 Plus, also known as Bluetooth Smart and Bluetooth Low Energy, by a factor of 4. That means a smartwatch or fitness band wouldn't lose its connection to your phone as you roam around the house. And if you have a motion sensor or lighting system that you'd like to set up outdoors, it wouldn't need Wi-Fi or another long-range network connection to stay connected up to your hub. As apparently they announced in February, Bluetooth also wants to standardize mesh networking support next year. This would allow a chain of Bluetooth devices to pass data from one node to the next. And then once they break your privacy, then it's every Bluetooth device is reporting on you. And it's suddenly, then you're going to start feeling like Tom Cruise in Minority Report before he got his eyes, you know, ripped out.
Eric, you didn't know you were going to come into Tinfoil Hat Central, did you?
Please be quiet. We don't want to hear any more underwear stories and hairy men and ordering shaving devices over the internet. Thank you very much.
Hey, at least if you'd gone to Harry's the same week as the whole underwear thing, it would have been unshaven men in their underwear.
No, don't even go there. Don't even.
You're the one that mentioned both of them in the same context.
I know, but now we're done.
Anyways, this would allow a chain of Bluetooth devices to pass data from one node to the next, with the potential to blanket an entire building with coverage. Mesh networking holds promise for smart home products as well, as it could allow for a decentralized system of devices instead of having to route everything through a single controller hub. I mean, so it does make sense. I mean, I was joking on the whole connecting all the devices. Like a Sonos, if you've dealt with a Sonos multi-room audio system, that's kind of a mesh network, although it's not based on Bluetooth. Beyond those IoT applications, Bluetooth is aiming to double the speed of data transfers without any increase in energy consumption, which is an important consideration for battery-operated devices like sensors. Although this could benefit consumers, the Bluetooth Special Interest Group says the speed increase will be especially useful for critical applications such as medical devices. So this is not going to be, so don't get crazy and think that this stuff is going to be out next week. It's going to be a while. They have to do the standards, and then device makers have to adopt them. But the odds are that there won't be longer range mesh networked Bluetooth products until late 2016 or early 2017. In the meantime, a small number of companies have introduced Bluetooth LE mesh networks of their own, including Zuli, which has the Zuli smart plugs. Let's see why this matters. I found this in PC World. Compared to other smart home protocols, and there are many, Bluetooth's advantage has traditionally been its lower power consumption, with limited range being the trade-off. And so now they're looking to eliminate their weakness and have a better, be a better competitor to the latest efforts from Zigbee and Z-Wave and so on. And so that's this current round of the news. I always thought, Bluetooth, it seems like
a solved problem.
Well, that was one of those that I kind of thought that the longer you go along, that the more it just becomes a way to hook up really simple things like your headphones to your phone or your Bluetooth speaker that you can pair with, that'll pair with anything. I mean, talk about promiscuous. If you have a Bluetooth speaker, you bring it somewhere, anybody with a phone that walks by and turns on their Bluetooth can pretty much pair up and play their music through it. But with Wi-Fi and some of that, it seems, you look at, Google Chrome and AirPlay and all those things, they're not using Bluetooth to make those work. They're using, they're using network. They're putting it on the network. And as the network gets faster, it seems like, but obviously that story didn't say anything about the possibility that there'd be other networking protocols to go with it. Because for Internet of Things, I get, Bluetooth, the nice part is it is supposed to pair up.
But, yeah.
And so so presumably you're tying it to your own devices instead of, whoever drives by. But it seems like you should be able to secure that. You would be able to secure things no matter what.
You would think. Man. you're starting to see all kinds of stuff in home automation that's got a big home automation turn with Bluetooth, but it's not just Bluetooth. Like, a lot of the stuff that I've got at the house uses like Z-Wave and Zigbee and X10 and all these other like secondary protocols. Well, they'll do their primary pairing will do it over like Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, but then the devices will all start talking to each other on their little private grid of Zigbee or whatever, which is interesting.
X10? Did you say X10?
No, not X10. Z-Wave. Z-Wave and maybe I did say X10.
You did say X10.
Well, X10 is still
suddenly it's 1998.
No. That's still a viable home automation protocol. You can go to like Home Depot and get like smart switches, like smart
for
digital
X10,
dimmer.
Really?
No. X10 is the protocol, not just the company name. It uses that X10 protocol. It's pretty common for like the you won't see it on like all the brand new fancy home automation setups, right. But anybody who has like something that exists like right now probably is using X10. Especially if they've had it for a few years.
Oh, that used to be you couldn't turn around without seeing X10.
It's like the original pop-up ad,
but
man.
Then that's right. But then they disappeared. I hadn't really thought about it.
Back in the day. No, still a common protocol.
They're sort of the equivalent of, if you're of a certain age, the old Radio Shack, the deal. Because back in the like 80s even, they had the thing that was like the box that had four buttons on it. So you could buy four connector things and control them from the one box. So it was like the lamest, you know, sci-fi type install for your house. Because there's wires, you know, a lot of them had to have wires running to them.
But it's all we had in the 80s, man.
That's true. And we liked it.
We liked it that way. Our home automation only had four buttons on it. And that was all we needed, because we only had four things we could do.
If we wanted voice control, we called your mother.
Oh, why'd you have to go there?
Well, no. At any home back then, what was it?
Maybe I called
your
mother.
Could you come in here and turn on the light? But tonight we do have, you know, we have our guest, Eric Berger, and so...
I wanted to ask Eric, some stuff, because I know he's kind of glazing over from some of the tech, but I wanted to talk a little bit about something that's near and dear to our hearts that we just finished with, I guess we are finished with it now, is hurricane season. We just closed out this hurricane season, right?
Well, Kate is still going, right?
Hurricane season, end of November. The Atlantic goes through November 30th.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So
happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. You think we're going to escape? We're going to have escaped this year, fingers crossed, without any significant activity for the Houston area. I think that's what it's looking like, right?
I go all in every year on September 24th as the last day you really have to worry about hurricanes.
Why September 24th?
Because there have only been three hurricanes that have ever hit Texas after that date in like 150 years. Wow. So while traditionally the biggest month for Atlantic hurricane activity is August, September, October, by the end of September, that activity has really shifted either to the east, to Louisiana or Florida, or the storms tend to get pushed south into Mexico.
Unfortunately, the three that happened after September 4th were Ike, Katrina. No, I'm joking. I know Zip about.
When was
and the 1904 Galveston hurricane.
That's what I was going to ask. When
Ike was a September hurricane, wasn't it?
Ike was September 12th, I believe.
And it was early September.
Hurricane Rita was September 24th, but that was obviously September 24th, but that made landfall technically in Louisiana.
But that's why Galveston's been unscathed by anything, because they're in a sweet spot. So the hurricanes will always go to the west or to the east.
Well, not now, Flicked. You jinxed it.
I don't think Ike felt unscathed during Ike, which is the third costliest hurricane to ever strike the United States.
The scientists in the late 1800s proved that. That's why they didn't build a seawall after Indianola got destroyed twice by hurricanes, because they built theirs in the right place. It was safe.
Touche.
Yes. So what about, surely you have insight already into how next year is going to go, because you're, you know, so psychic, like all weathermen are.
It's very interesting, actually. If you look at the long-range modeling for next year's Atlantic sea surface temperatures, it's almost scary warm. So whereas this year you had El Nino, you had very high surface pressures in the Atlantic, and which really acted to inhibit tropical storm formation, certainly the bigger storms. For the most part, there have been lots of little storms, but when you look in the aggregate of the overall activity, you measure sort of the duration and the intensity of the storms, it's been much lower than normal. Next year, I think you're going to have the potential to be quite a bit more activity in the Atlantic.
So why do they know, or why do they think that it will be warmer? How do they know that now?
Because they look at these seasonal modeling that can do things like surface pressure and sea surface temperatures to some degree of accuracy. It's far from perfect, right?
It's
right.
An old but, farmer's almanac.
And they have the weather corn, and they flip the weather corn.
I'm glad the tech guys are giving the weather modelers a hard time. I think I might get a little sympathy from this audience, but I guess not.
So what happened with the hurricane, the Pacific, I guess it's a typhoon, right? It's not a hurricane or something.
Although they've blurred it.
It was supposed to be like...
I could give you a technical overview of what is a typhoon like versus a cyclone versus a hurricane.
The super, you know, is like, oh my God, it's a category 6. Like, we've never seen this before. And then the next day it was not.
Hurricane Patricia, you're talking about?
I think so. It was just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, so Patricia hit Mexico, and it came up and came across Texas and actually brought us a lot of rain. Mm-hmm. We got lucky on that one because it was relatively mountainous, pretty close to the shore, and so some of the outer bands of the storm were affected by those mountains even before sort of the core came ashore, so it weakened, and it happened to hit a part of the coast that was not very populous.
So it lost a lot of momentum because too much of it was overland.
It lost a lot of momentum pretty quickly, and it hit a relatively depopulated area. so its effects were not...
Yeah, nobody died in Mexico, right?
Nobody died in Mexico. It was very fortunate.
Yeah, because they were sweating it in, what, Puerto Vallarta, they thought. I was reading where people were saying that the people, that the management at their hotel had said, oh, yeah, we're going to get you out of here. And then it's like, no, we're going to move you up to the higher floors of this Mexican resort hotel.
Do what now?
I guess so that the water won't get to you, except
cast you off into the wind.
It'll take several hours later before the water will get to you.
Would not want to be above the second
This way you
floor.
Can land in the water, and it will cushion your fall as the building comes down.
Yeah, wind speeds scale increase pretty significantly as you go up in the atmosphere.
So is the Atlantic going to be acting more like this next year look like it's going to be acting more like the Pacific did last year, where the warmer waters led to?
Yeah, this season in the Atlantic with El Nino, you had warmer water, you had lower sea surface pressures, which really drove a lot of activity. It's too early to really say anything meaningful about the Atlantic next year, but certainly I think you would expect to see a bounce back, and if the sea surface temperature forecasts are correct, you could see another year with 15 to 17 storms. And really, the United States has not been hit by a major hurricane since 2005. It's been an incredible drought. Ike was actually a Category 2 hurricane, so that's defined not as a major hurricane, although its effects were major. Sandy the same way, of major effects. But same with Florida. They have not been hit by a hurricane in a decade, and that drought does not exist in the hurricane record until now. So.
Ouch. What do you think of Houston's hurricane preparedness these days? I know, you know, after after Rita, the debacle that was Rita, that, you know, everybody who I've ever talked to since then has had their own special hurricane evacuation story. We all got one. You all were assigned a hurricane evacuation story after Rita. And then Ike happened, and Ike, we also evacuated for me and my wife, and it was a much less traumatic experience. In fact, we got in the car, drove up to Dallas, and everything was fine. But that was, you know, that was 10 years ago. What do you think we're looking like now if, you know, let's say next year happens, we have, you know, we have a week or two of warning as usually happens, and a major storm heads our way. What is the Houston-Galveston area look like from a preparedness standpoint?
So there's a couple things I would say to that. First of all, I would say that after Rita, the state did a pretty good job of recognizing the issues with, hey, you know, if you're going to be a major coastal city, you probably should have a contraflow plan for evacuation. And if you're going to have 4 million people get in their cars to hit the roads, you probably ought to have gas stations with extra supplies of fuel and water and things like that.
And the mayor probably shouldn't tell everybody to go ahead and leave at the same time as the first people that are supposed to be leaving closest to the coast.
So they came in and they made some pretty sensible decisions, although they didn't solve that problem because they wanted to have like one czar designated to call evacuation. So you're going to call Galveston and Brazoria County, then you're going to move inland to Harris County. They did not agree on that, but they solved the contraflow issues as best they can. Now, Ike was a smoother evacuation for those reasons and because only about half as many people left during Ike. All right, with that being said, the evacuation problem, I think, is manageable. What we have not done a darn thing about is two other major problems with hurricanes. One is storm surge, which we experienced during Ike, and there have been various solutions put forth to deal with that. Everything from the Ike Dike, which is too large and I think unwieldy to happen.
The what?
The Ike Dike.
That's awesome. I've never heard of the Ike Dike.
You haven't heard this?
Oh. I've not heard of the Ike Dike.
You have not been reading the Houston Chronicle, my man, because we
Ike Dike all the time. The Ike Dike was a $10 billion project basically to protect Galveston Island and Bolivar Peninsula and all of Galveston Bay from storm surge.
Okay.
And then that was scaled back to put a gate to basically protect the ship channel, and now there's other solutions that have been put forth. But it's now 8 years on since Ike. We have no momentum, and so essentially the community, and especially the residential areas where you and I live, Lee, in Clear Lake and in Lake City, and the ship channel with all of its industrial base sits about 15 feet above sea level. Mm-hmm. If you were to get a hurricane, which could easily push 22 feet into the ship channel, that is a disaster waiting to happen. We've done nothing about that, so we've lost our momentum against Ike. And the other thing that the region is wholly unprepared for, because it hasn't seen since Carla in 1961, is a major windstorm. So we're talking hurricane-force winds, 100-mile-per-hour sustained winds over inland areas. The building codes for most of the homes in the area were not built to withstand those kinds of winds. And so we're prepared to get out of harm's way, I think, but we are not prepared for a major storm surge or a major windstorm.
Well, that's great. Thank you.
Well, it makes me glad I live in San Antonio.
Yeah.
I'm moving to Portland.
I'm going to...
Fortunately, we all have windstorm insurance.
Portland's got its own...
I know. Portland has its own as earthquake issues.
Yeah, but. I mean, we all pay our flood insurance and our windstorm insurance, but at the same time, you don't... I mean, just because you've got insurance, that isn't necessarily really going to help you when everything happens. That's the...
I trust flood insurance a lot more than windstorm.
Well, I trust it all later. It just doesn't help you in the moment.
Yeah, windstorm...
It doesn't help you in the moment.
You for a long time.
And when you're trying to rebuild whole neighborhoods, you know, you're getting in line for contractors, and it just becomes
Plus you get into the whole thing where they tally up the damage amounts, and if it gets too far on your house, it's not insurable anymore. They actually keep, apparently, I don't know where they keep track of it, but now the new rules were to keep people from, essentially after like the third or fourth time they rebuilt the same house in the same place.
It's like, you're flooded, done. You can't live there anymore. You're
basically
done.
Basically, you're like, yeah, you can't get flood insurance anymore, which meant you couldn't get a mortgage.
So you're talking about the Bigger Waters Flood Act from several years ago, and I think that was a fairly sensible piece of legislation because essentially the federal government had been subsidizing people who were building homes right along the coast in areas that probably you shouldn't be building homes in. So the government came in and said, look, you either need to build your home up like 18 or 20 feet above sea level, or your flood insurance premium is going to go way up.
Well, is that separate from the buyouts?
Doesn't a subdivision developer have to carry some of that responsibility?
They do now to some extent, yes.
And
like if you're building in League City now, the city has a building code, which is like 16 and a half feet, I think, above sea level.
Okay. Yeah.
But a lot of areas haven't incorporated that.
Well, scary. That's awesome. I feel super great about going back home tonight. You need to
add a snorkel to your bug-out bag.
Yes. You can feel super great until probably about the end of July. Really for Houston, the period we have to be concerned about is from about mid-July through about the third week of September.
That August-September period feels the scariest every year.
Right.
That's kind of when I, even without meaning to, find myself checking the National Hurricane Center website at least once or twice a day, just kind of to glance at it, just to make sure that there's nothing crazy going on out of those crazy tropics with stuff coming our way. Speaking of stuff coming our way, I did have one other question that is highly weather-related and topical. Do you think we're going to see any snow this winter? Because I've heard rumblings that it is a possibility that we'll get
our... like a snow forecast that included Houston. Yeah.
That we'll get maybe... Because the last time we had any appreciable accumulation, at least down in Lake City where I am, was 2004.
That was great, wasn't it?
It was a Christmas Eve 2004. Yes. It was amazing.
It was fantastic. I remember playing with my kids in that. So the answer to your question is maybe. There's no way to forecast snow months out, even weeks out.
Don't you just know? You're the weather guy.
Yeah, well, so what we have is an El Nino winter, which typically means temperatures are a couple degrees cooler, and you're getting more moisture in the atmosphere. And so those are two conditions you need for snow, and so I think that this increases the odds, right? So maybe in Houston, every 4 years you have a snow event. Now, a snow event could be flurries, or a snow event could be a couple inches on the ground, as some areas had back in 2004. I think the odds are, basically going up from 1 in 4 this year to maybe 1 in 2, so a 50% chance. But unfortunately, that also increases the odds of ice or sleet, things that can kind of really, screw up the community because people can't get
out. Not be as fun to play in.
Yeah, no kidding, right? I mean, is it going to be, are we going to get...
But the viral videos are great.
Yeah. Are we going to get, do you think, cooler than average temperatures this winter, or is everything looking sort of normal?
No, I think we are. I think actually by about the week of Thanksgiving and into December, we're going to kind of flip into more of an El Nino-like winter, and we'll start to see temperatures cooler than normal. Certainly this fall, we've been several degrees warmer than normal for the most part, and it's been... even today it was in the low 80s, and
it's just warm.
Very high humidity.
Austin had a record. They set a record from 1962 it was 87 degrees in Austin.
In the valley, it was like 93 or 94 degrees today.
So when you say a few degrees cooler, what are we talking about specifically? And we're going to hold you to this.
We're looking at daytime highs. We're talking Fahrenheit, like 10 degrees. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Let me go home, wrap my pipes.
Yeah. On average temperatures.
Wrap my dog and bring the pipes in.
On average temperatures, 1 or 2 degrees cooler. But that means when you get the cold snaps, they could be, you could be colder than normal. But, we have had some really cold winters the last few years. I think it was 2012 or 2013 when temperatures got into the low 20s for parts of the Houston area. So.
I took a screenshot of Houston Transtar for the February 2011 big freeze event we had, where like we woke up and it was like 15 degrees all of a sudden. This was the morning commute. On there's, you know, I don't know, 30.
Show it to us on the radio.
Let me just hold this up to the microphone so we can see it. Yeah, I mean, it just everything's closed. There's all these, there's, you know, accident markers everywhere. Everything's red and yellow. I mean, it was like, you know, apocalyptic. And of course, I show this to my coworkers, many of them who are living in Chicago and Boston and parts north, and
they laugh, right?
Yeah, they were like, "What are you talking about?"
Yeah, well, this past weekend. It was, what, 65, 63 with some wind? And people were at the store. I go to the store. I'm wearing shorts. They're wearing, like, jackets and scarves. They had earmuffs on. It's just kind of...
I'm not sure if it was last year or the year before, though. Atlanta got hit by a sort of a moderate snowstorm, about 6 inches in ice, and it literally shut down the community.
I remember that.
The freeways were bad. It was like Atlanta fell off the map for days. The forecast for that actually
was pretty good. The mayor did screw it up, and the governor too. But
play it down.
They blame the forecasters when the forecasters were, go back and look at what the National Weather Service said and what they report, they were out of sync. But anyway, you can get some really serious events because people get stuck on the roads and they're out in cold weather and they're not prepared for it. So
yeah, here's a professional weather watcher's here's a pro tip for you. If the guy on TV is going, "Hey, it might snow," well. That just means that there's like an infinitesimal chance that it might possibly happen. When the National Weather Service says we're warning that in the afternoon of blah 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 that it's going to snow, take that one. That's the one to take seriously. The guy on TV who's got Sparky the Snow Dog out, because there's a possibility that you could see one flake in spring.
Not so much.
If you ask a meteorologist, a TV meteorologist, basically what they say is they're going to push that whenever there's any possible chance, because if they don't say it and it happens, they're kind of toast. Everybody calls in and complains and bitches, where the National Weather Service doesn't. They want to get it right. They don't want to. They're not caring about.
What's funny is that Eric, when he has done. Very sensible weathercasts on his Facebook page, people will come in and bitch at him as though he was...
Caused the weather.
Why
Eric?
No, because the TV guys were all like outrageous, and they'll come on and go, "You weather people," and he wasn't doing it, and he's had to I've watched him explain this.
And don't slag off the TV weather guys too much. I mean, I know most of them, and they do a pretty good job. But let's face it, the reality is for the newspaper business, for the weather business, for my own website, for the TV business, severe weather sells. Like people pay attention to the weather when it's flooding or snowing or very hot or very cold. So that's the moment. That's their moment to shine. That's when the spotlight is on them.
That's true. When they get to be up at the front of the news, too. They're not just buried after the sports.
Right, they're at the top of the hour. Yeah.
Yeah, and between this commercial and the sports, the weather, there it goes by.
Whereas they can put on their slicker and go out and be Geraldo.
Yeah. Go down to the seawall when the hurricane's coming in. I guess it's only the Weather Channel that really does that.
Oh, yeah, they do the heck out of
that
locals,
these days. I did see, in the past couple of years, there's been some virals where the local people went out to do the, to show you the hurricane and
But the Weather Channels, their format's all funky these days. What are they doing? It's not just like tune in and like watch the weather map and every 30 minutes the weather cycles by. They got all kinds of dumb stuff now.
They don't do weather on the 8s anymore?
I don't think so.
So the Weather Channel has really been struggling with the internet and weather apps and things like that. People don't need to turn into weather on the 8s to find out what the radar looks like in their area or to get the 3-day forecast or the current conditions. They can just open their iPhone app and look at it.
The Weather Channel app.
Right, yeah.
Or the Weather Channel app. So the Weather Channel a few years ago went to reality programming. for like 80% of its airtime or to something like that. And I think it was DirecTV, not Dish, that basically they got into a big fight with, and DirecTV said, look, you know, you're not doing forecasts anymore, so the customers don't need you. And it got into a really ugly fight. And actually, so the Weather Channel basically is really struggling. They've come back, they've sort of dialed back their non-weather dumb approach.
But they said, you're no different than the History Channel at this point.
Yeah.
But it really is. So they're dealing with that issue right now. And actually, they just got their digital properties got sold, but the TV station was just kind of left hanging.
Yeah, they're transitioning. They have Hitler's favorite weather forecasts from World War II, and they migrate back to regular weather.
What is Hitler's favorite weather?
I will tell you, there is a funny thing. I found this a few years ago. Hitler wrote about weather forecasting, and he basically, you know, said there are these freaks, these people with one arm, these social outcasts who can predict the weather, but even they're not very accurate. It was very, very demeaning.
Once I get the Ark of the Covenant, then I'll have my weather forecast.
So I've got my favorite weather app up here, the Dark Sky app.
Oh, yes.
This is awesome.
Yes, it is.
And it clearly, Eric, as you can see by this line of thunderstorms coming at us in bright red and yellow flames,
We're all going to die. Pack it up.
Which is to say, there'll be 15 minutes of light rain at some point tonight,
and it'll only get up to 70 tomorrow.
Look around the studio. These are the last human faces that we each will see. Awesome.
As compared to the Midwest and Missouri, where they've got tornado watches and warnings all over the place because it's really nasty up
right,
there.
Right.
Oh yeah.
We're just gonna get a breeze and a few degrees drop in temperature towards something like normal weather for mid-October.
Yeah. No, I'll take a few degrees drop in temperature. Jeez.
So you're listening to Weather Bites.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, weather's technology. There's like radar and stuff, right?
There's actually extremely technological solutions. I mean, the forecast models are they require some of the newest supercomputers possible because you want to run the models in the highest possible resolution.
You take the technology out of weather, and what you've got left is Uncle Bob's trick knee.
You take the technology out of weather, and it's basically the Farmer's Almanac. Right. That's right.
Well, there's a huge crossover.
Isaac's Storm.
There's a massive geek crossover between, like, you know, mainline tech geek and weather geek. I mean, I think probably there are Technology Bites listeners who have, like, weather stations on their roofs who are, like, part of the Weather Underground network. I don't doubt it. The Weather Underground station that's closest to my house that I usually... Let me see if I can... Oops, that's the Weather Channel. That's not going to help me. That's not what I'm talking about. I have it on my laptop. I've gone to it so many times on my desktop that it's like in my favorites bar and I don't even have to look at it. Anyway, it's like Nana's house or something like that is how it shows up in the Weather Underground station identifier.
Nana's house. What's the weather, Nana?
I don't know. Nana's got a great forecasting setup, I tell you.
It gives the forecast, and at the end of every one, it says, "And would you like some hard candy?"
I would. Thank you, Nana. I had a little bit of a cough, and I was really hoping. Yeah, see, here it is. Look, this is Nana's house. Is the default reporting station for my zip code when you go to Weather Underground.
There is one of my favorite websites during hurricane season. It's this one called SpaghettiModels.com, and it's a page that looks like it was designed in like 2001 and mostly tables, and it is and a spaghetti model. Eric, explain what a spaghetti model is.
It's the ideal pasta dish.
Spaghetti model. Go ahead.
It's sexy spaghetti.
So it's a spaghetti model plot. Basically, it's a spaghetti plot. Is you take all of the track model output. You take 10 different forecast models. They will each put together a track showing where a storm will go over a 5-day period, and then you throw them all on a map, and they kind of wiggle all over the place, and it kind of looks like spaghetti sometimes when there's not good agreement among the models.
So this is a page full of spaghetti model maps from a bunch of different sites. And it's just like, if you're into weather, and if, and particularly during hurricane season when you're paranoid as hell, it's a great place to go and just kind of like soak it all up. SpaghettiModels.com.
Either create your denial or get your fear on.
That's right.
Get your fear on.
So I found what Hitler said about forecasters, if y'all are interested.
Yes.
He was basically...
We've already opened the door. We might as well go through it at this point.
He was making the argument that weathermen ought to be separated from the army because they weren't suited to wear uniforms. So he says, weather prediction is not a science that can be learned mechanically. What we need are men gifted with a sixth sense who don't know anything about isotherms or isobars. One of them will have a humped back. Another one of them will be bandy-legged. A third paralytic. Similarly, one does not expect them to live like bureaucrats.
And he said, I and my crowd of paralytic humpbacks will celebrate our weather forecasting victories in Moscow.
So we'll have the superior
in
weather
December.
Forecast.
So, yeah, his paralytics kind of missed that Soviet forecast.
So this is why Eric is so good at forecasting, because he's got a bunch of humpbacks in his... in his basement, in his house. And what's going on out there?
I thought it was his fake leg that did it.
He's got a cluster of them.
What do you call a cluster of them?
I don't think we can say it on the air, even though we don't have the list of...
Right, yeah. Let's close the door and walk away from it.
All right.
Well, we are running close to... I think we've only got a...
It's almost time
what,
for that
a couple more minutes
ID
before...
Thing?
Because there's extra station IDs this time,
okay.
I think, aren't there with the...
I don't know. They're not showing them on the play thing.
Oh, okay.
The play thing?
So,
is that
so
the technical, got the technical
play,
description?
The playbook?
So how much time does it look like we have to, that we need to fill?
It looks like we've got normal time.
All right. We'll keep babbling.
So, you know, you got a minute.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that's
one
not
minute
worth
before the music starts, and then about another minute.
Let's coming see, up do on the second a... hour of Technology Bites...
Yeah, we're going to talk about nothing but Pluto with Eric.
Excellent.
Oh, we could do that.
Yeah,
I was
we
gonna,
should talk Pluto.
We should talk Pluto in space, because that's Eric's other big thing.
Right. Pluto and rocky Earth-like, Earth-sized exoplanet.
Yeah, we can save the iPhone, iPad stuff for next week.
And Encephalus.
Ooh. Let's talk
Enceladus.
About it.
Enceladus? Is that
what you're
saying?
Oh, I've been saying
you're not sending rockets and spacecrafts up to find diseases.
Out of your nose?
I've been saying like Encladus or whatever. How do you say it?
Enceladus.
Enceladus. All right. Well, there you go. Now I know.
This sounds like something you'd get in the produce section at Whole Foods.
This small moon of Saturn that is spitting its oceans literally into space.
Either that or I thought I saw a commercial for Enceladus. It had a lot of side effects, though, at the end of the commercial.
Ask your doctor if Enceladus is right for you.
All right, well, we have consumed the first hour.
Chomp, chomp.
And we will be back in a few minutes, so you want to stay tuned. You are listening to Technology Bites. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Lee.
I'm Dwight.
And I'm Eric.
And he's...
Groovehouse.
And that was about perfect.
There we go.
KPFT invites you to come hear economics professor Richard Wolff, host of Economic Update on KPFT, which you can hear every Monday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. at Houston Community College, West Loop, Friday, November 13th, 2015 at 7 p.m. This public lecture is a benefit for the station and a rare opportunity for you to hear this advocate for economic democracy and a leading thinker regarding our current economic system in person. Richard D. Wolff is the author of Democracy at Work, Capitalism Hits the Fan, and several other books, and is also currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in International Affairs of the New School University, New York City. He teaches classes regularly at the Brecht Forum in Manhattan. If you're interested in the kind of analysis and economic prescriptions offered by Professor Wolf, leading towards a more equitable result for all, then please join us in supporting the appearance of this crucial thinker here in Houston. Tickets are $20 per person, $10 with a student ID, and available at the door, or in advance at wolf.bpt.me. That's wolff.bpt.me, or visit kpft.org for more information on attending this event with Professor Richard Wolf. KPFT Houston.
Hey members, it's forum time. The KPFT Station Board election forums are happening next week. We've got three for you, and we know you're ready for them. Mark your calendars for next Tuesday the 10th at 9 a.m., Wednesday the 11th at 5 p.m., and Thursday the 12th at 9 p.m. Listeners will be able to call in to the live on-air forum to present a question to the candidates. If you would like to email a question ahead of time, please email Natalie at kpft-les@pacifica.org. Thank you.
This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. We now return you to Technology Bites.
Oh, we're back somehow.
So, let's see. Do we have a Barrett time tonight? Anyone?
no. Where's Barrett tonight, did he say?
He's out of town. Yeah, he's in Boston.
Boston?
He's up north.
Land of Dunkin' Donuts.
He parked his car in the Harvard Yard. He's talking like Peter Griffin now. When he comes back, that's what it'll sound like.
That's my main exposure to Boston was several years ago. My very first trip there was for a conference, actually. It was for EMC World, which was being held in Boston that year. And the bus driver of the shuttle bus that was moving us between our hotel and the convention center told me for like 20 minutes when he found that it was my first time to Boston that I had to go to Dunkin' Donuts every morning for coffee. And I was like, really? Coffee at Dunkin' Donuts? And he's like, and he launched into like this profanity-laden speech about how Dunkin' Donuts coffee is the best coffee. And
the
like,
best
when
friggin' coffee.
Best, yeah, coffee. It's better than any of that other coffee. It just, like, went on. Just, yes, it was just, like, F-bomb, all kinds of just incredibly creative foul words. But he wasn't saying them, like, in a mean way. It's just that was they were just coming out of his mouth as part of the speech about how amazing Dunkin' Donuts coffee was. Apparently you have to get it with the cream and the sugar in it, otherwise it's not all that great. But when you get it that way, it's the best coffee in the world. Every other coffee sucks. That's the only coffee. And I don't think we ever actually went to Dunkin' Donuts. I think we just like had like the conventions in our coffee every day and then left.
Now they're coming to you.
So we should put him up against like a Krispy Kreme fiend and like just watch them like attack each other.
Vibrate and explode.
Well, the problem is Krispy Kreme's out of the Carolinas, so the person would just be, I think they might have trouble speaking after the Boston guy did his profanity-laden tirade about why you should do... Well, bless your heart.
Did you welcome us back to Technology Bites?
Welcome back to Technology Bites.
Welcome back to Donuts
they
Daily.
Have it automated, yeah, to Dunkinology. This show is all dunked up, but...
I see what Dunkin'd you did up. There.
Anyways, well,
why don't you science us here? I think we'll probably just have an all science second hour. What do you say?
We can do that, and if we run out of time or run out of stuff to talk about, we've got plenty of other things.
Heck yeah, man!
So
hit the thing.
We have this totally fluid format.
We do. Whatever we like.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious
science. All right.
You like that high-tech bumper playing method that we use there with the AIM microphone at the laptop?
Very nice.
That works. It works as well as
I probably shouldn't have exposed the secret
doing
on the air.
At some point, we'll have a dedicated machine that will have those kind of sound files that I can even play remotely.
A bumper robot?
Sort of, yeah. Okay, well, just do a quickie on some of the science stories, and then we'll launch. Then we can go into the whole Pluto thing. In science news, the world's largest nuclear fusion reactor is about to switch on. So cue the same panic that people had with the Large Hadron Collider and the any well, other.
There's going to be a black hole that's going to go into the center of the Earth and destroy
tinfoil
the planet.
Hats.
But let's see. It looks like a piece of technology straight out of science fiction, but the Wendelstein 7X, W7X, Stellarton fusion reactor is totally factual, and it's going to go online this month.
What did you say the name was?
Stellarton.
What was it?
Wendelstein.
Huh. That sounds made up.
Wendelstein. I think it's like a brand name. Stellarton reactors such as the W7X... produce energy by using massive coiled superconductors to create powerful magnetic fields.
It's Wendelstein!
Frankenstein!
Frau Bucher! according to Gizmodo, the W7X takes the Stellarton design to a whole new scale, featuring a 16-meter-wide ring covered in 250 access ports that contain 56-ton magnetic coils.
I think it's really cute that we're trying to create our fusion reactors here on Earth when we have one in the sky that's going to burn bright for about another 4 billion years.
Right. It's a pretty big one from what I hear.
That is not going to run out of fuel. And it is always on, doesn't require any maintenance.
But it's so far away.
Yeah, and we haven't made a lot of progress on building our Dyson sphere yet.
If you look at the efficiency of solar cells and the cost, it really has come down dramatically over the last 10 years. And, you know, fusion is always, the joke is it's always 20 years away. And I think that that's true.
Well, affordable solar is only 3 to 5 years away perpetually.
Affordable solar is essentially here.
Pretty close, yeah.
It's just not here.
Right. It's not like here.
So when I was on vacation and before my vacation turned into a lengthy hospital stay, I was in Albuquerque. And in this little town outside of Albuquerque called Corrales. And everybody in Corrales has on their roof solar panels. Mm-hmm. And
they have like a collective that does it.
Yes. And my, people we were staying with get a check each month instead of paying an electric bill.
Is it the electrical company? Elon Musk people?
No, that's Solar City.
and most of the people in this town are like this. And everybody has, it's New Mexico, so it's abundant sunshine, right? But it wasn't that expensive, and they have made their money back, and now they're making a profit as a result from doing this.
So the first thing is that the technology had to be there, and that is right in terms of solar efficiency of solar cells and the cost to produce them. Now you need a couple other pieces. One, you need a way to store the energy to use it at night. And that really is where you mentioned Elon Musk, his Powerwall battery technology is really an important key step toward that. And then the other thing you have are sort of some practical financing things. So when you buy a new house now, you can get added to your 30-year note. You can amortize your solar system over that time frame. And if it's, $200 a month for the solar system to pay for it, well, that's your electric bill instead of that. And after 30 years, you own it. And so it's, these things are changing. It's happening slowly. But I think solar energy increasingly is going to become how new construction gets their energy from.
But for an existing, in a state like California or New Mexico, there are clearer paths forward. But like, here in Texas, for example, if I wanted to go bolt solar panels onto my roof, I don't really have a lot of options if I'm not building right now.
No, you can get it done. I mean, I think the legislature has passed laws such that the neighborhood association cannot prevent you from doing that, even in a state
There's
like
also,
Texas.
In San Antonio, San Antonio didn't buy into the deregulation thing when that was the big trendy deal about 15 years ago. So they kept their city utility, and it's called CPS. CPS is actually looking to find people who will let them put solar panels on their houses. They want the best candidates. And then you get a little discount on your bill, but this is CPS doing it because it helps CPS, not because they want you to have solar panels on your roof. It's them, instead of adding more plant capacity for summer peak, they can put solar panels out around, and it's already distributed. They don't have to do all the they don't have to build the extra power lines to get the power out to wherever, and they control it and all that. So when it starts working for city utilities,
yeah. So it's not an electrical engineering problem anymore. It's a civil engineering problem, and those kinds of solutions I think we'll see start to come increasingly fast.
Yeah. So the day after they come out with where $1,200 will get you your solar installation and your batteries, then the guys will come running out of the fusion lab and go, "We did it.
It worked. We don't need this anymore."
Now it's still kind of expensive, but in another 20 years we'll have the price down.
Right.
Speaking of Tesla, this isn't about batteries though, so it doesn't fit in with the whole other thing. But Tesla is working to develop a new electric motor that could help people keep their luxury electric cars even longer without expensive mechanics bills. Their goal is to work on a new version of its electric drive unit that could have a lifespan of 1,000,000 miles. Is the
idea?
I
don't remember off the top of my head what the existing warranty is for the Tesla motors, but I know because they're like the fancy brushless crazy ones that it's significant. It's not like 10,000 miles or whatever. It's a lot.
The current level they'd been working towards is 200,000 miles for their electric drive unit, and that's the part where that's the part the drive unit's part that holds the electric motor or both motors in the dual ones. So CEO Elon Musk mentioned that the team has now shifted its focus towards a much longer endurance, shooting for a 1,000,000 mile engine. Of course, how many times do you have to swap out the batteries to get
Batteries are rated for 8 years, I think.
It depends on how many miles you're
putting on it, and that's an expensive part of the car. That's 30-40% of the car's value is the battery pack.
And I think if they're successful, even if they're only partially successful in this, if they're half successful and they can only get 500,000 miles, this will do on the car front what we were just talking about for the solar panel on the utility front, which is it will be so dramatically superior to the existing option. There's very few people who get to brag that their Volvo has 500,000 miles on it. But if your car comes with a warranty or comes with the expectation that the motor will work for 500,000 miles right out of the chute, I mean, you can see where Musk, at the very least, he has the right goals. I mean, obviously there's the reality of, is this accomplishable without unobtainium
kind of thing. I don't know a whole lot about Teslas, but I'll tell you a little funny story. About that. About a year ago, I was talking to a guy named Dave Scott. He was the Apollo 15.
I was going to say, the astronaut Dave Scott?
The astronaut Dave Scott, the commander of Apollo 15. He lives in Southern California now. And he was saying, yeah, and apparently it's a pretty well-off neighborhood. My neighbor was bragging about how he's got two Teslas in his garage. And he said, I wanted to tell him that 45 years ago, I drove an electric car on the moon. He was not impressed with the Tesla.
A folding electric car. That was. I saw a documentary talking specifically about the Lunar Rover stuff.
Yeah.
And it was just crazy, the constrictions on what they could do
The Apollo 15 was the first time they took a rover to the moon, and they had to like basically strap it to the landing.
Went into one of the LEM equipment bays.
Yeah, exactly. It was quite a quite an engineering feat.
It was
there.
A fine Boeing product that lunar rover was.
So, the final news story on science, and then we can move on to Pluto, back in towards Pluto.
Pluto.
There's a new exoplanet on the galactic map.
What's its name?
A rocky planet roughly the same size and density as Earth has been discovered orbiting a nearby red dwarf star.
What's its name? Is his name Bob?
I don't know that it's been named yet.
Bob. Planet Bob.
This was thanks to new data gathered by telescopes in Chile. Located 39 light years from our solar system, it's the third closest transiting exoplanet we know about.
Is that after they gave up on the one that they found that wasn't real?
Planet Bill?
No, there was the one of the early ones from a few years ago. They said,
"Oh, right, that's right." They decided, "Oh, that wasn't really
that
a
actually
planet
wasn't
there.
Really a planet. Yeah. It was just like the blip in data that that we misanalyzed.
Oh, yeah, right. That was right before they figured out that the signal they were listening to from outer space was people opening the microwave. Door without turning it off.
We're getting this beep every once in a while, this blast.
It's but amazing. You can't predict when. It always happens when Bob goes to lunch.
So I appreciate the humor here, but trying to find an exoplanet with the Kepler Space Telescope is essentially like looking across the country from Houston to L.A. at sunset and seeing a car turn on its headlights in Los Angeles. So they're sort of trying to tease out very subtle variations in the brightness of these stars as these tiny planets pass in front of them. So it's difficult work to do it.
Oh, yeah.
I also would say that this exoplanet, I saw this story, this paper come out, and I was not very impressed. It's basically a Venus-like planet. The atmosphere is
hothouse kind of thing.
Hothouse kind of thing. And my takeaway is this is 39 light years away when we have a Venus that's 39 million kilometers away that we really haven't explored. I mean, the Russians have landed on it briefly, but we've done all this stuff on Mars, but we really haven't explored Venus. And so I'd actually like us to explore Venus.
It's a complicated planet to land on. I read about the Venera probes that Russia did. There's actually a great website. I can't think of the name off the top of my head, but there's a great website that's got all of the reconstructed photos from the Russian Venera probes. Actually showing the surface of Venus, which is, as you can imagine, it's a really crappy looking place. And the pictures, though, are of excellent quality because they've been digitally reconstructed. And like reading some of the stuff that the Russians had to do, the Soviets at the time had to do with the probes, just to guarantee that they would last like for 90 operational seconds after they landed was like amazing. Like, you know, encasing the cameras inside of like lead shields with like, you know, 6 quartz mirrors to reflect the light in. Because, and then like, and even after all of that, the probes would melt within a very short amount of time, or at least like sort of become temperature non-functional and deform because the pressure and temperature was so great. I mean, the upshot is that landing on Mars is an extremely complicated problem because of the very thin atmosphere, and you've got to probably do it as a powered landing, and it's really... Landing on Venus is actually relatively easy because the atmosphere is almost like soupy. You know, you don't need a whole lot. You don't need a tiny parachute. You can land, no problem.
I think you could make the case that outside of Sputnik and Gagarin's flight, the Venera probes on Venus were the greatest success of the Russian and Soviet space programs.
I would agree with that. It's kind of amazing. It's not, not a lot
not
of people
very well
know
about
them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's. I mean, if you go to Google, let me see if I can do it just real quick, and you search for, let's try Russian Venus probe.
You're not gonna have people
type in
Venera.
You just do Venus Flanders, you get it.
V-E-N-E-R.
No, I wasn't gonna go with that. Oh yeah, I mean they're right in. They come up right in like the top Google listing.
It's
pretty
incredible. If you
go to Google Images, you can see them. Space.com's got a write up. I think the second link here on from Mental Landscape is the one that I was referring to that has all the. Yeah, this is the site with all the photos. Yeah, it's amazing. You can go out there and look at the pictures and the stuff that the Soviets were able to accomplish in, when was this? Late 70s, early 80s? I think so, looking at this. Late 70s.
Have there been any U.S. landers on Venus?
No.
No, we went out. We went to Mars and some of the outer planets, and the Soviets, focused on the inner solar system to differentiate themselves from not duplicate efforts. And, you know, so the capitalist pigs did
that
Mars,
and they lost
so.
Their Martian orbiters and landers.
Well, no. Not for glory of Soviet Union, we land on Venus.
Well, I'm surprised that the steampunks haven't kind of pushed for the whole Venus thing, because the stuff I've read is the idea that you could do like airships and stuff that would be a lot simpler in the upper atmosphere of Venus because of the, you know, soupy...
If you could get over the pressures and temperatures high enough to melt lead, then...
Well, but you don't have to go down to the surface.
There
if you're up higher, then it's going to be...
There have been some ideas to do Zeppelin-type explorations of the upper Venus atmosphere, and there was some light and noise on that earlier this year, I think, talking about NASA was considering it, but they're...
We want our cloud city.
I'm pretty sure Lando or Calrissian could figure it out.
Their planetary exploration budget is almost entirely consumed by Mars.
We need a Kickstarter with the with the actor who played
Billy
Blaine,
D. Williams.
Billy Dee Williams.
Send Billy Dee Williams to Venus.
I guarantee.
Colt 45 will get you there.
Every time. Every $20 donation to our Kickstarter, you get the special Cloud City edition of Colt 45. Well, so on this rocky planet that they found, the way they found it, they say it each time they find one, but it's worth it. If you haven't heard, the main way they find it is by, the planet transiting across the surface of its sun reduces the brightness of that sun, and so they can tell. That gives them the ability to tell kind of what size object they're dealing with and how far away, those kinds of things. So,
actually only one sun.
But no, he's talking about the
star.
Exos. Oh, okay, all right.
The star.
Sol.
Yeah, there's yeah.
The other star.
So they're stars. This one, part of why it was easier to find is that it's a red dwarf, as I mentioned earlier, which is much fainter and smaller, about 10 to 20% the size of our sun, making this new planet much more visible. And since it's relatively close, then scientists think they'll be able to study this planet in even greater detail. The next closest Earth-sized planet around a red dwarf is 127 light-years away, which is too far for scientists to characterize the planet. But due to the proximity of this new world, there's hope of figuring out the gases that comprise its atmosphere. I'm guessing that, as opposed to Venus, they're hoping that it's going to have more oxygen and less toxic atmosphere.
My understanding in reading the technical paper was that the atmosphere was probably going to be a lot like Venus. That's a
lot of CO2.
So this article is sort of playing up the Earth-likeness.
Yeah, I think they're trying to make it more Earth-like than it really is. It's more Venus-like than Earth-like. The interesting thing about this discovery is that red dwarfs are the most common star in the galaxy, so that we'd like to know if you can have habitable planets around red dwarfs. And so that's why there's pretty great interest in finding more of these planets, to see if we find Earth-like planets around them, then we know that, there is an increased likelihood of many more Earth-like planets in the galaxy.
Red dwarfs are cooler, right?
Yes.
It was a great show on PBS.
That's why there's a whole series.
I thought it was pretty cool.
Smegging awesome.
Literally and physically cooler.
Yeah. Hey, there we go. Now, is there a – so for exoplanets like this and for – is there an IAU, naming convention or whatever for them? Or is the IAU responsible for that? Is there any kind of international overseeing body that's tagging names onto these?
Is there a website where I can go and buy it?
Is it the International Astronomers Union?
Or did what they call this one right now –
I think you can pay $29 and name it.
No, that's not binding.
That's
International Astronomical Union.
Paid the star hustler behind the con $25.
How many stars you want, buddy?
I got some discounts. They're coming to the end of the con. No, this one is actually called GJ1132B.
Yeah, and that's a designation from the Kepler Space Telescope, I think. They sort of designate the stars, and then they designate the planets around them.
Oh, and in case the lack of Earth-likeness, regardless of they haven't really studied the atmosphere or they not in specific yet, the temperature ranges between 278 and 572 degrees Fahrenheit, which is hot enough to boil any liquid oceans away.
Too hot for me.
It's so close, quote, it's so close, the coolest its atmosphere gets is about as hot as your oven can get in your kitchen, said Berta Thompson.
No, so maybe like Brownsville.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like Brownsville.
Or Earth circa 200 years from now. No, but the thing is, it is cool enough to support a complex atmosphere, and no, that is not an evaluation of nightlife or any of that, which scientists are eager to study. They hope to analyze the light from the red dwarf as it passes through the edges of the atmosphere, because obviously the light wavelengths change when they pass through different types of gases, so by observing the various wavelengths in the atmosphere, they can figure out what the composition is in specific. So, obviously, hearing the other stuff, including the inhospitable atmosphere and the huge temperatures, it's unlikely that GJ1132b has any life on its surface, although it may have one or two of Shatner's hair pieces. Studying its atmosphere will provide good practice in case we find another rocky Earth-like planet in a much more habitable area of space.
All right, well, I have a general exoplanet question for our resident exoplanet expert. Exoplanet expert. Say that three times fast.
Our exo-expert.
Exo-expert. Why, what combination of instruments are being used that's led to, like, this recent, within the past, you know, 5 to 10 years of all these exoplanets that are popping up? Because I don't remember hearing, you know, when I was a wee one, I don't remember hearing anything about any of this until relatively recently we actually started to get confirmed
most people
were
always like, there's no way to know.
Yeah, yeah. It's not until relatively, just in the past few years that we've started to actually have not just, like, theories about exoplanets, but actual, you know, data on them. So what are we using, and what's it coming from?
So there were various techniques. The first exoplanets were found in the early 1990s, and these were very large planets.
Like, so Jupiter-ish.
Bigger than Jupiter. Okay. That you could sort of tell with their star. And then there were three or four different techniques that were basically designed to find these so-called hot Jupiters. It's kind of funny. Out of context, how Jupiter sounds pretty interesting.
It's like a drink you get at a space bar.
Dwight, over to you and the hairy website.
Hot Jupiters and hairy websites. Yeah.
But anyway, and then the Kepler Space Telescope came along.
Is that one of the great observatories?
I'm not sure if that was technically a great observatory, but that was a NASA instrument that basically sort of used this technique to study looked at thousands of stars simultaneously and look for transiting planets. So you look at a star basically for 3 years, and you would measure very small variations in the brightness of the star. And if it was periodic, say if it came back every 6 months, and you had a planet that was passing by every 6 months. And so Kepler gathered all this data and had all these planet candidates, and then they came back with ground-based observatories to try to validate those observations by looking at the stars. And so the great 90% of the exoplanet discoveries are due to the Kepler Space Telescope.
And what about this bizarre story about there were, like, two explanations for it. It was either the debris of a comet, or it was some
they
giant
thought that it was a solar cell civilization
from an alien civilization.
The alien.
Talk about how that what that.
So
was.
that star, Kick something something something, which has a super long name. The idea was that periodically for long periods of time, it would dim in brightness by about 20%.
Not enough, or not. Like, longer than would be explained by a transiting planet.
Yeah, but sometimes it was, like, for days, like 50 days, the star would dim. And there was no natural explanation for that. They didn't have any other stars that they've ever observed that have done this. And so there'd been a lot of chatter. And then a couple months ago, it came out sort of in some of the literature. And if you sort of went down the possible explanations, what you were left with was that it was an alien civilization that had built a Dyson sphere or something like that that was collecting solar energy, and that's why the star was dim, because this periodically would move in front of the star. And so last month in October, SETI actually aimed some of their telescopes aimed one of their observatories at the star, which I forget how many light years away it is, to see if they could get any signals. And they actually looked in the microwave spectrum, which they would have expected to see. If you had spacecraft flying around the system, they would have seen emissions in this microwave part of the spectrum. And long story short, after 15 days of observation, they didn't find anything of interest, but they're going to keep looking. Astronomy is still a relatively new science, and there's a lot of universe to look at. And so I think there's probably some plausible natural explanation. This is just something we haven't seen yet.
Yeah, I think one of the obviously the press, like, leaped on stellar civilization, Dyson sphere.
I'm not saying it's aliens.
But it might be aliens.
But
it's aliens.
Yeah.
The History Channel's already done 6 hours.
I'm pretty sure it's aliens. No, but it also, I think there was some, you know, it could be a planet that has been destroyed, or it could be large amounts of debris kind of thing that were potentially more realistic.
It is 11, you know, you can't get there in 11 parsecs, and it is where the planet Alderaan is theoretically going to be.
As if a bunch of alien enthusiasts cried out at the same time.
I mean, it's a fascinating mystery, and that's one of the great things about science is you sort of look at data and you find interesting things, and then you try to come up with theories to explain it. And the there are no plausible theories that really explain why we are observing this. So now
the first question I had when somebody talked about a giant solar energy array is, why don't we have one of those?
Because we're only a we're only like a tech level zero civilization instead of a level one or level two.
We have iPhones.
Because it cost $150 billion to build the space station. And when you were flying the space shuttle to get 1 pound of stuff into orbit, so and imagine how many pounds of stuff you would need to try to build this kind of array was is $25,000.
Because Dwight, instead of continuing on from the atomic age into the space age and the modern space atomic age,
we
detoured into the information age where we quit doing anything involving like the atomic age.
So we can look at porn on our iPhone.
That's kind of like the trade-off, I guess. But you know the downside is we don't have the massive nuclear-powered heavy lift capability to, you know, launch billions of tons of solar arrays into space and harvest the energy of our star.
Instead, we would be like roping asteroids and like, you know, mining the moon and stuff, right? You wouldn't lift it off the Earth, probably.
Potentially coming. Maybe.
So it's my impression, and I may be completely wrong, but I bet Eric knows. It's my impression that there is a renewed
moon base
sense
on the dark side
among the public.
It's a good movie.
In the possibilities of space. Do you think that's true?
Not really.
Oh, damn.
Even after The Martian?
I don't think so either.
I think in the abstract you can find a lot of people who are enthusiastic for things, but then it takes too long.
Well, there's the public support for
our society isn't set up to
public support
stick with the project long enough.
Public support for space is a mile wide and an inch deep, I think, is a good way to put it.
Well, there's a perception that NASA is incredibly expensive. I mean, there's that like
it is.
There's that.
Well,
it's not.
We've done it,
that's the thing.
Well, we did it the American way, which is like we set this crazy goal that if you really look at it. It still is an amazing accomplishment to send men to the moon.
That's one of the greatest things, possibly the greatest engineering achievement in the history of mankind.
And
yes.
So, you know, there's a reason they call it, you know, projects like that, they call it a moonshot.
Well,
the problem is they do it once.
So here's the deal.
It's like, okay, we did it. Let's, you know, go home, pat ourselves on the back for the next 40
years. I'm researching a piece that I'm perpetually researching because I don't have time to write it anymore about the history of Soviet rocketry. And there's an amazing professor named Asif Siddiqui who is probably the authority on the Soviet space program. And I sat down and interviewed him last year in prep, which is how long I've been researching this stupid article that I'm never going to get to finish. And we talked a little bit about that, about, you know, the scale of moonshots and the grandeur of Project Apollo and the space programs of the 60s and the sort of the lack of follow-through. And Dr. Siddiqui said something really interesting. He said that it's possible that the space race in general, and Apollo in particular, did us a very grave disservice because it set wildly broken expectations for what a national space program should look like. You know, we started off, it's like, you know, we started off doing this absolutely amazing, incredible achievement because, you know, the government was given basically a blank check because there were so many political, you know, you had to beat the Russians, and it was this whole big, like, Cold War thing. And we ended up, you know, actually sending people to the moon with 1960s technology, which is mind-blowing. But that's, like, Siddiqui's argument was that's so far off the norm from what we should be expecting from a national space program. That was, like, the one-in-a-billion thing where, like, everything lined up and that happened, and it'll probably never happen again because it's so far out from what the public would normally tolerate from any kind of national expenditure. And what we have now with, you know, we're farting around in low Earth orbit and, you know, we have to have multinational partnerships even to get off the ground. And, you know, we talk about maybe going to Mars and maybe go to the moon and maybe we're going to build SLS as the next rocket. That's much more in line with like what people normally do with government programs.
So we just wasted 40 years.
We just need to convince the American public that there are terrorists on the moon.
No, what's going to... Well,
and then we'll
yes.
get to the moon.
Or oil. Oil
then,
on the moon.
And then when they're not there, we go, no, they're not on the moon. They're actually on Mars, and then we can get to Mars.
What's going to end up happening, and Eric, you can shoot me down if you don't think so, but what I think is going to end up happening is what you're going to see is China, which is absolutely convinced that it wants to join, it wants to get out of the kiddie pool and get into the big superpower pool. One of the things that you have to have if you're a world superpower is a space program. What you're going to see is China continuing to push its space program and drop billions and billions of dollars and probably eventually land, what are we calling them, astronauts, Sinonauts?
Tychonauts.
Tychonauts. Probably eventually land Tychonauts, Chinese astronauts, on the moon, and we'll get a nice big communist red China flag at a landing site on the moon. And that's going to be, in my opinion, kind of the last chance, really, to motivate the American public. And it'll happen, I think. I'm really sure about it, but I don't know if we're going to even, at that point, care.
Yeah, the problem is that by then, Americans will be sitting in their combo recliner toilets and rattling their...
Eating their, bachelor chow.
Their super double... size slushies at their TV.
So, what do you think? Is that off base, Eric?
Watching Ow My Balls.
So a couple thoughts first before I answer the question. First of all, I think the Professor Siddiqui was right. The Apollo moonshot was sort of way above grade. I think Apollo did us a disservice in another way, because it's like we flew a 747 from, you know, Plymouth Rock to California, right? We never built the railroad to space. It was the way we went to the moon was completely unsustainable. It was this huge program, tens of thousands of employees, 5%, hundreds of thousands of employees, 10 or 5% of the federal budget. You went there, you put boots on the ground, you came back, and then you had nothing sustainable left. It's, you know, we went to the moon in like an airplane instead of building a railroad, kind of across space, and so. You really need to get a sustainable development. And the other answer to why we didn't go beyond that is that when you really break it down and look at where you can actually go as a destination with people, if you want to go put your boots on the ground somewhere, there is nowhere else to go but the moon. Mars is an order of magnitude harder. Now, we could do it. If you gave NASA 5% of the federal budget now, their budget would go from $18.5 billion a year to... you know, 150 or 170 billion a year for the NASA budget. They could do it then, but that's not going to happen. And it's so much harder to go to Mars than it is to go to the moon. And so the only really place we can go is we can go to the moon.
Well, careful. Buzz Aldrin's going to come punch you.
He's going to kick my ass on the way of getting his ass to Mars. Well, it's interesting. That's where Buzz Aldrin is. But when you go talk to a lot of the other Apollo guys, the people who did it, many, if not most of them, would much rather see NASA go back to the moon.
They had it mapped out. I mean, that's the other side of where it was, a quote disservice is, once it was done, then everybody, especially politicians, decided since we did it over and over again, we did it to the point where apparently it was boring, so we canned a mission.
Canned three missions.
The point of missions, but that's
that then it, so it's just easy. So we don't have to worry about that. And then we went off into the. Where politicians decided they could design the space shuttle and give it all kinds of specs to get it past.
The space truck.
That's really not why the Apollo program was canceled. The Apollo program was not a program to go to the moon. The Apollo program was a program to demonstrate to the world that the United States, and it was a democratic superpower and it was superior to the Soviet model. And once we did that, once we beat the Russians by putting humans on the moon, the utility of the Apollo program to the national interest of the United States was fulfilled.
Right.
And the space program budget plummeted, and space is
it actually started plummeting in 1968 before the first landing, because at that point everything was, you know, was rolling.
Well, at that point they had planned, though, to leverage the having gone to the moon to like set up the kind of space station.
That gets into the Apollo applications program
and all of that, but
it's a mess, man. Now I'm all depressed. Great. Well, thanks, Eric.
The sad thing is that number, that 5% of the budget and all of that, and yeah, okay, you're for those of you who need a trigger warning, this has got a tiny bit of politics in it. We have that money. We have that 5%. That money could be gotten. Of course, we might have to give up a couple of fighter planes for it, or one of those, or a couple of ship programs. But we could do that, and the money is there for. It's a matter of where our priorities are, and I'm not saying that one is superior to the other, but it's not like that number, that $178 billion, while to you or me is a considerable sum, to the U.S. government. When it's towards towards some goal that it really wants to accomplish, is virtually
nothing. You want to talk about Augustine, or you want to talk about Augustine?
With that being said, I'm not convinced that dumping another doubling or tripling NASA's budget is going to get you really where you want to go. The way really to open up access to space is to lower launch costs. Okay, if you can get stuff into space, people and supplies. At a reasonable cost, you can do all sorts of things in space. The problem with NASA is that since Apollo, it has not focused at all about lowering launch costs. The space shuttle, as I mentioned earlier, was $25,000 a pound, which is completely unsustainable to try to get people and things into space. And NASA, even with its current program, is actually going away from reusability, and it's the rocket it's building is extremely expensive.
I have no idea what the SLS payload cost is, but with the launch rate being as low as it is, it's got to be through the roof.
It's the program cost itself, whether you fly it or not, is $3 billion a year. The answer, I think, is to go to reusable rockets, which is what you see Elon Musk doing. It's what you see Jeff Bezos doing. It's what you see sort of a lot of these private space companies
trying to do.
They have not succeeded, although SpaceX seems to be getting pretty close, and they've already slashed launch costs as it is. They are looking to develop lower-cost launch vehicles because they realize that to make a business case to be in space, you have to get there in an inexpensive manner.
But that's – so that's what a lot of new space companies are trying to do, and some of them are sourcing rockets, and then you run into situations like with Orbital Sciences, with not RS-68, but with the surplus Soviet engines that they were slapping on their rockets, and you potentially have problems. There's other new space companies that are trying to control the whole vertical and build their own rockets and engines and everything. SpaceX is taking kind of a middle ground. Actually, SpaceX is doing a whole vertical
SpaceX
thing
is
too, aren't they?
Vertically integrated. They're building 98% of their own, except for their struts, unfortunately.
I'm going to throw you like one of those really goofy ideas, but we're talking about launches. What if you could get to space without a launch?
Well, now there are some innovative ideas that one of the big problems with launch technology is that we're still using Robert Goddard's rockets. This technology is nearly a century old. And you talk about the revolution we've had in communication, that's changed dramatically. The physics and the basic formula of a rocket engine has not changed in decades and decades and decades. The engines used in Apollo were decades old concepts by the time we got there.
I had a lot of readers ask me when I went to Marshall to look at their resurrected F1 engine testing, why are we studying these old engines? Why aren't we building new engines? Because the technology, the chemistry, and the physics is kind of the same stuff.
Yeah.
If you're talking about using combustion to get to orbit. This is what we've got.
NASA's new rocket, the Space Launch System, the great rocket that's going to take us on our journey to Mars, uses space shuttle engines.
Well, to be fair, uses space shuttle engines because there are 19 space shuttle engines sitting in storage. And they were like, well, we already paid for them.
The space shuttle main engine technology is nearly 50 years old. And that's our generation of future rocket. But anyway, to answer your question, Dwight, there are some alternative ideas that are being looked at. Some of them are like Stratolaunch is taking a big airplane up to, I think, about 30,000 feet and then trying to fly up from there. There's actually some really innovative balloon launch ideas that are starting to come down the pipe. I think, there really needs to be kind of a revisiting of cheaper ways. And that's why you saw the space elevator talk over the last 10 years or so. Sort of new ideas are needed. And unfortunately, NASA is not looking into those.
Yeah. Well, what you have essentially in a launch, whether it's a vertical launch or a railgun launch or whatever, is it's an investiture of energy. You have to take some certain amount of energy of and shove it into this
thing. A lot of energy.
It's a tremendous amount of energy, and shove it into this, you know, capsule, spacecraft, project, whatever it is that's going to orbit. It has to be invested with that energy, and chemical rockets are one of the most efficient ways to do it. But it also, they're really, really loud. They're incredibly expensive.
And they're expensive, right.
And potentially unsafe because they might, you know, you're basically sitting on millions of pounds.
They're bombs.
Yeah. We know how to blow stuff up. That's the easy. That's our.
But that's what you do. You have to, because to hit into, you know, to low Earth orbit, you need to have a sustained velocity of 17,000 some odd miles per hour. And you have to shove that energy in there to get up there. And that's the other thing. You don't really go up. You go up for a little bit, but mainly you go forward so that you can get in your orbit so that you can continue to fall forward without hitting the ground.
Is there any anti-gravity research being done?
Anti-gravity is such a funny thing because that gets into like spooky quantum physics. Gravity is a function of, you know, gravity is a function of mass.
I think electromagnetic railguns are cool.
Thanks, man.
Well, in that one, at least there's money being put into it because they're using it for some weapons.
There was one
on
Reddit.
There's actually some dude
on Reddit built one
somewhere. Well, the Navy has a
railgun
on
scary
one of their
one.
Ships. Yeah. But it seems like, you know, I think one of the, you know, to build on what you were saying earlier, sort of the, one of the core things is, you know, Apollo came out of a desire to impress, and so we came up with this goal, and it was a pinpoint goal, and
we just met
that, and we're done. You know, go to the moon, put people on the moon, bring them back safely, kind of thing, where society didn't change underneath that. And, you know, you kind of wonder if we had taken the path, you know, you talked about, like, the go to California, you know, you fly a 747 to California and never build railroads. Well, a lot of the technologies that we've never explored, even terrestrially, maglev and that stuff in the United States that we've never invested in or never taken advantage of or looked to for the future, you know, I guess in a sense, you know, I would hope it changes, but seems kind of typical for us. I mean, the railroad tracks that you see the stuff go down right now in Texas are the tracks they were running on in, you know, 1840 kind of thing. You know, they're 100, almost 150 years old, a lot of them, and we've never, you know, once that worked, we could never like take that next step. And I guess we're finally doing it.
A lot of it's public interest. And like, so I mentioned very briefly just a minute ago, the Augustine report, which was a report commissioned on by the Obama administration about like what can NASA do, essentially, what is the path forward for NASA. It was chaired by Norman Augustine, who's a veteran of the aerospace industry, ran Lockheed Martin for many years, and had a number of very notable people like contributing to the report. Basically came away with a number of different conclusions it would take far too long to go into, but one of the report's conclusions was that for and this was in, oh my gosh, what, 2008? 2008 or 9, I think.
I
think it's 2009. Yeah, so one of the conclusions of the report was that NASA's current plan at the time was Project Constellation, which was sort of a combo plan
Apollo
to reuse. Apollo on steroids, reusing a lot of shuttle hardware. The report's conclusion was that it was on an unsustainable path, but for an injection of $3 billion in cash and then an inflation-adjusted increase, tracking with inflation over the next like 10 years, it would have been totally sustainable. So you wouldn't have needed, you know, $150 billion. They needed $3 billion, and then an inflation-adjusted increase year over year from then on. And Congress really wasn't even willing. You know, at the time it was 2009. It was the economy collapsing, housing crisis, whatever. Congress wasn't even willing to locate and contribute $3 billion of additional funding, which honestly I think you could probably find sticking to your shoe as you walk through the halls of the Capitol. It's like, oh, I just found $3 billion. It's like it's on the floor. not even that was willing to be contributed. So that's where we are.
I think we, you know, and I may be totally misreading it, but one of the things is I think we're going to see a big snap towards a more future-oriented government and focus of our society once the boomers kind of pass off this mortal coil, because they had their hit. You know, they got to the moon. That was on their watch. That's done. They didn't need to spend money on it. They have other concerns for their lives now. and that kind of optimism, because, you know, I'm old enough that I saw the end of that kind of the 60s and of that time when America could do anything, you know, set a mind to it, science, engineering, we could do it. Well, now we're the we can't do it kind of thing. Oh, no, we can't afford $3 billion. We can't. We got to do we've got other priorities, or we can't get into, we can't even get a small enough percentage interested. Now, if, unfortunately, if we could only find a way to like tie it to Star Wars and not the missile defense thing,
now there's
you
an
could
idea.
Get people to like, if you buy a ticket to Star Wars, then we have to spend $10 towards some space program
that's actually
that's sustainable.
Kind of brilliant.
That is actually. A
we will not idea. Release. Like we'll give you. We'll give you. So there's episode 7, 8, and 9.
Kickstarter.
We'll give you episode 7. But we're not releasing episode 8 unless you agree to like donate money to NASA, and only then. We're not gonna do episode 9 until we have people on Mars. So you got to contribute even more money before you see the last one.
Then we will never see episode 9.
Well, or then you've got the biggest problem is that thing that's at the back of lots of people's heads, which is, what if episode 7 sucks?
Well, let's not.
It is a possibility.
You've already bought your tickets, haven't you?
No, I haven't bought my tickets already. I'm going to go to a press screening. I don't need tickets.
Oh, but I did see a thing where, I'm not going to gamble my money on this. I'll
so
go to
we don't meeting. Have much time. Let's talk about sure. Pluto.
Oh, we were going to do that.
So I want to hear Eric's thoughts on Pluto.
What are your thoughts on Pluto, Eric? Is it a planet?
Pluto is a surprising planet. So
what's this? So the latest thing, this ice volcanoes? Is that what we were talking about?
So yeah, there was a big division of planetary sciences meeting this week in Maryland, and the Pluto people were out in force making presentations. And probably the most interesting thing was sort of a deeper dive into the ice volcano and active geology of the surface of Pluto. And basically what that means is you have mountains that are 10, 12, 13,000, 15,000 feet high on Pluto with big holes in the top of them that look a heck of a lot like volcanoes. And you have parts of these planetary surface that looks unchanged in terms of the cratering over 4 billion years. But you have other parts of the surface of planet, the heart region, which is called the Sputnik Planum in Tombaugh Regio, that there are almost no craters, and actually half of the heart is completely free of craters, and they estimate that that surface is less than 10 million years old. And there's no weathering or anything like that on Pluto. The atmosphere is very thin, and so what is remaking that surface? And the thinking is that there must be some kind of underground geology at work, and so it's an active planet. And they look at these large mountains with holes in them. They say those must be volcanoes, and those must be cryovolcanoes, which are erupting ice.
Now, this is all from data that are being slowly trickled back from New Horizons, right?
This is data collected by New Horizons basically during a 15-minute flyby of the planet. It took all of this high-fidelity data, and it's sending it back now over the next year.
Why do they think it's spewing ice and not just...
Because there's not magma, and there wouldn't really be enough energy to make rock molten.
Yeah, they'd be able to measure the heat.
It takes a lot less energy. So the thinking is that there was some kind of residual radiation heat from the silicate core of Pluto that is producing enough heat to basically move ice around.
We're not talking water ice, though. Hmm? Are we? This is not water ice.
Oh, yes,
it?
We are talking
water
we are
ice.
Talking water ice, and it's so cold. The surface that the ice is, you know, I'm not sure of, you know, precisely how to characterize it, but it's harder than steel. I mean, the ice, you know, these mountains, you know.
Did we expect Pluto to have that much of a concentration of hydrogen and oxygen and carbon?
No, we
and all
thought
that stuff?
The thinking was that Pluto would be a not like Mercury, but pretty much a geologically dead world because it was so far out, so far away from the sun, and it had existed so long. It would not be geologically active. There just wouldn't be any heat. Where's
right.
the heat coming from? And it's interesting, you look at Charon, its moon, which is about half the size of Pluto. That is more like what we expected to see. Almost all of the surface of Charon is 4 billion years old, uh-huh. or 4.5 billion years old, and it's cratered and so forth. So the big mystery is sort of what is the heat that's causing Pluto to sort of remain active.
Well, I'm not saying it's aliens.
But it could be aliens. Yeah.
It could also be, I mean, what? What else? What else are we talking about?
The two
about?
Big. So the
this is like tectonic activity.
The prevailing theory is that there is some residual radiative heat from the from the silicon in the silica core. Another theory, which geologists always go to, is that at some point there was some kind of impact, impact with some other object. Could be the formation of Charon, and that left some residual heat that has slowly been burning off from the core of the planet. But they, you know, they're not sure. They hope to figure that out.
Or a Dyson something or other.
Yeah. Dyson vacuum.
But yeah, the fan without the blades.
This is fascinating. What I mean, it really kind of blows my mind that this is all coming from a single 15-minute flyby, and it's the transmission rate that's so low. There's so little bandwidth available to the probe.
Years to get the data.
They've collected 4 months. They've collected data over the last 4 months, and it will take them another 12 months to get all of the data collected during the flyby.
And this entire time, New Horizons is like booking it.
Now almost 1 AU, so that's astronomical unit, the distance between the sun and the earth. It's already almost 1 AU beyond Pluto.
Wow, that's totally cool. Yeah. Space is cool, man.
Space is pretty cool.
Space is cold.
Yes, thank you, Dwight.
No one can hear you scream there. I've heard.
What other body in the solar system do we? I mean, what other body in the solar system really is left for us to throw a? To throw like a big probe like this.
So the big three are Europa, a moon around Jupiter, which has oceans that are 60 miles deep, water oceans, an extremely interesting world, Enceladus, which is a tiny moon of Saturn, which, as mentioned earlier, has fissures in the ice, and it's literally spitting its ocean into space, and actually rain from Enceladus is falling on Saturn.
Cool.
And then
it is cool.
It's very cool. But that world is much smaller than Europa. Europa is about the size of our own moon. And then there's Titan, another moon, which has lakes, liquid lakes of methane. It's very cold, but methane stays in a liquid form down to, I forget what the exact temperature is, but there are literally lakes of methane. You could take a boat and sail it in the lakes of Titan.
So NASA decides its exploration priorities for stuff like this through a, I'm going to get this wrong, so you have to correct me, through a decadal survey, right? So every 10 years or so, there is a massive set of conferences, and NASA sets its priorities for, like, we have so much money we're going to spend on big, gigantic missions for science, we have so much we're going to spend on kind of B-tier missions, and then we have, like, the little bitty tier. So any one of these potentially could be or already is a target on one of on the upcoming decadal survey or the decadal survey that we just got.
So in the last decadal survey, the top two targets were a sample return from Mars, which
would be cool.
NASA is trying to do, and then Europa.
Out of those two, which would you rather see?
Oh, we've done Mars. I would much rather see the outer ocean worlds explored.
Mars is so old.
We already had a movie about that, although we also had...
and the movie also told us to stay away from Europa. Said attempt no landing there, man. That's neat. So you think there's liquid oceans under the ice, no question. It's not just...
It's not a matter of thinking. It's clearly there are deep, deep liquid oceans, and there's internal heat on Europa because of the tidal forces exerted by Jupiter. Very likely you have black smokers in the ocean.
Possibility for little pockets of life, like at the bottom of Earth's ocean, that surround the
possibility for life throughout the ocean. I mean, there is plenty. Yeah, there is plenty of energy. There is plenty of. I mean, you need a source of energy. You need water for life to exist, and Europa has them both in abundance.
Cool, man. Is there a monolith there? Have we seen it yet?
It's probably not a monolith because the surface on the planet literally creaks up and down. It's because it's so tidally distorted by Jupiter.
So if Europa had an atmosphere, it would make a lot of like scary, creaky ice noise at incredible volume.
Yes.
I know we're like a minute out from closing, but is the outer ice layer of Europa like condensed frozen atmosphere? I think I read something about how it might be or not, or is Europa too small to have its own, to have pulled its own atmosphere together?
We don't know. We don't know how thick the ice is. That's one of the things we hope to find out.
And finally, what's your thoughts on the Fermi paradox? Just kidding. We don't even have much time to tell you what the Fermi paradox is.
How much time do we have?
Go look. You can Google that one safely, I believe.
Read your margin notes.
But you have listened to another fascinating episode with our wonderful guest, Eric Berger.
Thank you, Eric,
for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
You are certainly certainly welcome to return, and we can especially, you know, when there's space news that you want to talk about, definitely get in touch with us, and we can have another one of these conversations. And so we will be back next week with a different crew. Still no Jay Lee, but with the more normal crew. And
normal.
I will be
for
back
or what passed for. Oh, yeah, oh, Dwight will too. Awesome. Okay, it'll be sort of a throwback show in a way.
Yeah.
Maybe
all right.
We can actually take calls.
Maybe
if you. You really want
it's up to?
To
you, Mel.
We have to talk to Groove House.
All right. Well, you have been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Lee.
I'm Dwight.
And he's a Tychonaut.
We out.
Hi, Dwayne Bradley here. When you support KPFT as a listener member, you get a great feeling that comes with contributing to keep your independent local community radio station on the air, and you also have the right to vote in the election of our board members. As with any election, candidates make a variety of statements about what they can and want to do. Pacifica's bylaws assign 13 specific tasks to our board members, and you can view our bylaws at pacifica.org. We at KPFT encourage you to read the candidates' statements also at pacifica.org. The station depends on your vote and your involvement in the process. KPFT is required to reach a quorum and must do so to move forward. If you feel you should have received a ballot by now but haven't, contact our election supervisor Natalie at kpft-les@pacifica.org. Thank you again for your support of KPFT Houston and for your vote in the 2015 local station board election.
You can help KPFT by donating your unwanted vehicle. When you make a donation, your vehicle is resold at an auto auction and the proceeds help to support KPFT. KPFT accepts cars, trucks, motorcycles, and recreational vehicles. Your donation qualifies as a charitable deduction on your federal income tax return because KPFT is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Just call 855-KPFT-CAR to make your donation. Please be ready to share the title, location, and general condition of your car. This information assists the tow company in scheduling appropriate towing arrangements. Again, the number is 855-KPFT-CAR to make your donation. Thanks. This is 90.